think the idea of memes transforms the way we think about human evolution. For a start, memes are what is imitated, what we copy from person to person. So I would say what makes us human, and therefore different from every other species on the planet, is that we alone can imitate high-quality copying of what other people do. No other species can do that. A few species can just slightly copy, but very, very badly indeed. We are unique in that respect.
So it's not the originating that's the important thing.
Right, it's the copying. Yes. Now, that doesn't make sense in an ordinary way of thinking about human beings, because most people think, well, you know, originating is what's so clever, copying is really boring and ordinary. But that's what's bamboozled us, if you like, because we don't realise how important copying is. If you think about how evolution works, what Darwin saw, Darwin's central idea, what we might call now the evolutionary algorithm, is that if you take something, some kind of information or some object, and you copy it lots of times with slight variations, and then you only copy again from the most successful of those and all the rest get killed off, then you get change and design out of nowhere. So the importance of imitation is that it is really the importance of copying in an evolutionary process. You see, what Darwin saw, what we now call the evolutionary algorithm, is that if you take something, anything, any kind of information or any kind of object, and you make lots of copies that are slightly different, and you kill off most of the copies and then just take one which happens to survive or whatever and copy that and keep doing that, design comes out of nowhere. That's where design comes from. Now, take that principle for biology, we're all familiar with it with genes, but take it for culture, for words, for stories, the things we copy to each other, apply the same principle, and that's where design comes from again. So all of human design, all of human creativity, I would say, is an evolutionary process that depends for its existence on our capacity to imitate. Our capacity to be creative and invent things comes straight out of imitation. If we couldn't imitate, we couldn't be innovative.
And the suggestion is that this is why the brain is so large, not for originating, but for imitating.
Exactly. Because imitation itself is a difficult thing, so it takes a lot of brain. And secondly, once you can imitate, you're just taking in so much stuff. Once you can copy, you hear someone say something, you can copy it and remember it yourself. You hear another story, you hear a song, you learn how to make stone tools. There's so much to be fitted into a brain. And if you look back in human evolution, the people who had a bit bigger brain and could fit more of these memes in and pass them on would be better at hunting, at finding mates, at getting food, I mean, everything they'd be better at. And as everyone's brains got bigger, so if you had a small one, you'd be left behind.
So right now, the things we can do that you would describe as memes, why do we do it? Why are some memes more successful than others?
Ah, well, that's two rather different questions. Why some are more successful than others is a lot of different reasons. They appeal to us in some way, we like them. The stories we pass on, for example, will be because they're funny, because they tug at our heartstrings, because we know somebody else is interested, because they're true, because they're useful to us in our jobs. Any number of reasons is why we pass them on. But the more general thing is, like, why are we doing this at all? I would say, really, we human meme machines are infected by memes. They're like an infection. We catch them. We get infected by, for example, a religion or a scientific theory or a belief in astrology or whatever. These are like infections, and sometimes we can throw them off. Very often we can't, and we integrate them. But it's all happening just because it can. The memes are using us to get themselves propagated.
And so you're suggesting that religions are just a highly successful collection of memes?
Exactly that. Exactly right. You've got it. They are a memeplex, a co-adapted complex of memes, which is highly successful. If you take a religion like Christianity or Islam, I mean, they're the worst, really, ghastly duo, they are, each of them, a package of ideas, like, let's say, in Christianity, the virgin birth and the Trinity and all of these kinds of things. And those ideas are passed on, packaged with a whole mass of threats and promises. So if you pass on these ideas to the next person, then you might go to heaven and you'll live a good life and think you're a good person. But if you reject them and don't believe in them, you'll go to hell and burn forever. So people are forced by the threats and promises to keep carrying these memes and passing them on to their children. Now, I mean, that's horrible and scary, but I think that is the best way to describe religions.
This is slightly tangential, but you published a book called Conversations on Consciousness, which is a series of conversations that you had with neurologists and with philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Metzinger, in the interview that you did with him, was very regretful that we are losing metaphysical beliefs in God. We are losing religious beliefs because that was what gave societies coherence. If everybody stopped believing in a soul, what is that going to do to the way we treat each other? Now, if you reduce everything to a series of opportunistic means, then you're going to have the same question that he's posing. What is going to become of our society?
Yeah, I don't think he was regretful. I think he agrees. He was just, he's looking at the dangers, and I agree with him. If you believe that we are only moral and good because the religions have taught us to, and if we didn't have the religions, we'd all fall apart and be horrible to each other, there would be a problem. I think it's exactly the other way around. I think people are horrible to each other much more when they're religious. Religions start wars, they start fights, they split families apart, they make arbitrary and vile rules, they cause enormous harm to society. There is evidence, interestingly, that shows if you compare different societies according to how religious they are and how socially healthy they are, you find that the more religious societies have higher rates of suicide, murder, violent crime, rape, incest, all the sorts of things that religions are supposed to stop. You know, they are actually higher in the more religious societies.
I was going to suggest that communism has all those things and more,
yes,
and yet is entirely irreligious, but I presume that you would suggest that communism itself is a collection of abhorrent means.
Yes, well, they're not all abhorrent, no, but it's a collection of means put together in a package like that and passed on in that way that infects people, and it can have those effects. So to go back to Thomas Metzinger's question, then what happens if we get rid of all those? We have to think, what is human nature actually? We are a social species who work cooperatively in groups, extraordinarily so. Actually, our inherent human nature will give us a morality. It will give us the concepts of fairness, of kindness, of sharing, of looking after your family rather than others, possibly, and there are problems in that, possibly in being racist because you're more likely to care about people who are like you and so on. But at least we have the groundwork laid in our biology for being kind, generous, social creatures. I think we could be better morally without religions rather than the reverse. But you know, it's an experiment we need to... It's quite a dangerous experiment to watch happening.
Does that all mean that our self is a collection of means?
Yes. Yes, I do think it means that. It's very natural for us to imagine that we are kind of a little self who lives inside our brain and kind of pulls the string and controls our actions and has free will and experiences the world. But there isn't anything inside a physical brain to correspond to that. You know, there's just billions of neurons doing their stuff. So how come, if the self is an illusion and there isn't really something there, how come we feel so strongly that there is? And one way of thinking about this is the memes do it. It is to the advantage of the memes that we have this word I that describes, sort of starts off describing your body when you're a kid, but later it describes I, me. Well, this little me in here, this doesn't exist. Because the memes will be propagated by this body here saying things like, well, I believe in Jesus, or I believe in astrology, or I want to go to New Zealand for my holiday, or whatever it might be.
It's an extremely good marketing campaign.
Yes, yes. And so the word I thrives and keeps being passed on and gives rise to the illusion that there is somebody in there who has the beliefs and is conscious and makes the decisions, when actually we're just massively complicated meme machines that are making their own decisions.
But is there no choice on our part as to which meme we adopt or subscribe to?
Yes, there is. Each meme machine, each person, will reject some memes and accept others. But that in turn is going to be because of, on the one hand, the genes that gave them the kind of brain they have and, you know, how healthy and how intelligent and everything they are, and on the other, the previous memes they've had. So the first thing that happens is most people learn one language first. So you will only be able to pick up memes in that language. There are non-verbal memes, of course, art and pictures and things of that kind, but you're constrained by your language. But then if you go to school and you're highly educated and you learn scientific thinking and rational thinking and you learn other languages and you learn the history of art and whatever it might be, then the memes you can take in will just expand and expand. but you won't be taking on, you know, Chinese memes or ideas that don't get into school or whatever. If you have a very limited education, you're going to be deprived of a whole lot of memes, but also you won't get the skills of rationality and scientific thinking and so on that enable you to repel certain memes. So it's all an integrated effect that ends up with some meme machines, you know, taking on some memes and others not.
So it doesn't affect the nature versus nurture argument in that we are always either pro or anti, available or unavailable to certain memes as a consequence already.
What it does to the nature-nurture argument, I think, is to make it a three-way argument instead of a two-way. I mean, we're familiar with nature-nurture, in which we have, well, some things are there from the beginning, they're forced into us by the genes and so on, that's nature, and on the other hand, we have all our experiences. Now, if you bring memes into it, you say, right, well, we've got nature, which is set up by the genes, which are a replicator, this information being copied. And we've got the environment out there. But we've also got memes, which is another replicator. The memes themselves are fighting to use our brains. So it's a three-way fight in which the genes and the memes and the environment are all interacting with each other. Now, if you try and force that into nature-nurture, are memes nature or nurture? I mean, kind of nurture, but they are very different from the traditional sense of nurture because they themselves are replicators fighting to get into your brain, competing to get into your brain. So it changes the argument quite substantially.
So if one was stripped of memes entirely, you would have somebody who had complete amnesia?
No, you wouldn't. And that's a good question because it shows up how much of our lives have memes and how much isn't. So you would still be able to remember, much as a dog or a cat or a pigeon, you know, they can remember all sorts of things. For example, my cat knows its way around the garden, it knows where the hedge is, it knows where's a good place to sit and watch for birds, it knows what time to come in for its dinner. I mean, you know, those things would stay because those are not got there by memes. Anything that you learned for yourself, like how to ride a bicycle, how to run without falling over, how to skip, whatever things you've learned like that by yourself, would be still there if all the memes went. But you would have total amnesia for every story you've ever heard, you wouldn't be able to speak anymore, you wouldn't have any language, you would not be a full human being at all. You would be like a cat or a dog or another mammal.
You suggested that memes, I think, supply an argument that explains altruism better than the selfish gene, a la Richard Dawkins.
It's not that it explains it better, that it adds something else that I think we need. That altruism is quite a mystery, because why do people go around being so nice to each other when it's not necessarily in the interest of their genes to do so?
You mean complete strangers, not part of your kin group,
part of your tribe. Exactly that. Now, from the memes point of view, it could be very valuable. And if you get infected with memes such as, you know, be nice to send money to help the starving in Africa, for example, within a society in which all these memes are going around, it can be the case that you will be seen in that environment to be a good person if you give that money, and you want to be a good person because, you know, we've been set up genetically to want to be good people.
Or to be seen to be good people.
So those memes will then thrive on that natural tendency of us to want to be good people. That's a rather cynical way of looking at it, but there are other ways in which memes will encourage altruism. For example, this is a very, very simple thought, really, that a nice, kind, generous person who's always friendly to their friends, gives time and money and resources and whatever to people in general and is very kind and so on, will simply be with more people. Because they're a nice person, everyone likes them. So they will spread their memes more. And it's in the interest of those memes to use those people to get spread. And that will include the memes for being nice and being kind and throwing good parties and giving people a nice dinner and all of that. And the mean person, a horrid, you know, stay by themselves, never says a kind word to anybody, doesn't ring up their friends when they're in trouble, frankly, doesn't see so many people, they don't like them, that person.
And so why have they been so resistant to the memes then?
Why has who been so resistant to the memes?
The nasty, miserable person sitting in the room.
Who knows? I mean, they could be like that just because they're genetically disposed that way. They could have been abused as a child. They could have, you know, any number of reasons. It doesn't matter. The point is, from the memes eye, well, it matters to them, but from the memes eye point of view, memes that can get into a meme fountain, the sort of person who's always spreading memes because they're kind and generous and fun, will be an advantage to those memes. And that will include the memes for being friendly and fun and generous and giving away things.
You are Zen Buddhist?
I'm not a Buddhist. I will not sign up to it. You can imagine, right. Can't you? I'm not going to sign up to some religion and say I believe everything.
Well, there. Yeah.
But I've been practicing Zen meditation for more than 20 years.
All right. So which came first? Your pursuit of the concept of means or the Zen?
Because the Zen came long, long before.
And does that feed into your idea about means, given, you know, the loss of self, I imagine, is inherent in Zen?
Yes. And one of the wonderful things that's happened in my life has been a sort of coming together of things which really early on were quite separate. On the one hand, I was learning science and philosophy and studying and thinking about things from a scientific point of view. And on the other, because of my weird experiences, out-of-body experience and other things that happened to me, struggling with the nature of consciousness in my own life, taking drugs, training as a witch, all sorts of weird things I did, learning meditation. The meditation began to take hold as a worthwhile thing to do and something I wanted to learn how to calm the mind and observe more clearly, and started doing that for that reason. But then discovered that actually the ideas did come together. So, for example, I now think of Zen meditation, very simple, you know, sit down, look at the wall, shut up, you know, calming the mind stuff. It's dropping the means. When you sit and meditate and all this stuff comes, the stuff that comes is not, oh, you know, I remember that beautiful mountain I saw last week, which would be non-mimetic. It's all the memes. It's arguing with yourself. It's words. It's getting cross with things. It's being annoyed with yourself. It's tangles of words. It's tangles of memes that get in the way of a calm mind.
Presumably you lose the good memes as well as the bad.
Absolutely. Memes, yeah. And one of the Zen things is non-discrimination. I mean, Zen practice is open awareness without discrimination. Absolute equality to everything. Non-judgmental. You don't judge this as good or bad or anything. In deep meditation, it's simply sit, be, this is how it is. Not, I want that and I don't want that. So yes, absolutely, all memes, they're just memes. Let them go. Be able to inhabit calm, totally open space.
When you talked about, you know, your earlier experiences, your out-of-body experiences, drug experiences and so on, this was part of what you wanted to shuck off, was it? Or was it something that you wanted to further investigate?
No, it was kind of, those were all things I did in as a kind of investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there I am as a, you know, excited, open-minded, interested student, not understanding the nature of the world, fascinated with all, you know, I was fascinated with all sorts of things. But because of the experiences I had...
Which were like what, exactly?
Well, the most dramatic was a two and a half hour out-of-the-body experience, which was extraordinary. It happened to me as a student in 1970.
Because why? Any reason?
I don't know. I was very tired. It was my first term at Oxford. I was burning the candle at both ends. I'd been doing a Ouija board session all evening. I was running the Psychic Research Society, which I did.
How many reasons
years.
Do I need?
I was smoking cannabis. Oh. I mean, you know, plenty more reasons. But, I mean, you know, these things were quite common at that time. I don't know why it happened then, but it was extraordinary. That, but other things as well, but that...
Can you just describe it for me?
Yeah, I was sitting there listening to this music. I think it was probably Grateful Dead or Pink Floyd or something like that, you know? And in my mind, sat on the floor, late that night, I was going down a tunnel. And it was like a tunnel of trees, like a road that's grown over in the autumn with, you know, leaves everywhere, leaves on the ground, leaves all around. Going down this tunnel towards a bright light at the end, listening to the music. And one of my friends said to me, "Where are you, Sue?" Obviously, I must have looked a bit, like, weird or something. And I was like, where am I? And it was as though I thought, I'm not in this tunnel. Where am I? I know, I'm in this room in college. And it, like, came clear as though I was sitting on the ceiling looking down. And I could see the whole room clearly as though from above. I could see my own body and my friends. And I went, I'm on the ceiling. I'm looking down. And I could see the mouth, my own mouth down there, you know, opening and shutting. Weird, absolutely weird. I mean, I'm sure now I did 20 years research on out-of-body.
Well, exactly. Places. You went on to investigate that.
I did.
That.
Yeah, I did.
And found?
And found that the brain is constructing all the time viewpoints, which normally it constructs a viewpoint from behind the eyes looking out, but it can take alternative viewpoints.
Right. And you'd had a what somebody else might call a disinhibited brain at that point.
Exactly. That's the idea that I came to. You're quite right. That disinhibition in the brain. I mean, the brain has a lot of cells inhibiting other cells to keep everything in line. And many things can cause disinhibition. All the things I told you about can, you know, exhaustion, excitement, drugs, you know. With disinhibition, you get a lot of random firing all over the place. You will get, if you get random firing in the visual cortex, you get tunnels. which is why you get them in near-death experiences. And the bright light is because of this excess firing. And you will also get the flooding of memories coming up. And you'll also get in the left, it's actually induced in the left temporal lobe. It's quite odd, we can pin it down now and induce it. You get this sense of the body lifting up and of being able to move even though you're not moving. So it all makes sense now. But at the time, I thought, oh, this means there's a soul or a spirit. I also wanted to get back there because it was so wonderful and so vivid and had this sense which people describe in mystical experiences of, oh, now I know. Oh, this is right. This is more right. This is more real than ordinary life. So all of these things, to go back to that question that you asked me, all of these things, studying Zen, trying other kinds of meditation, learning biofeedback, training as a witch, studying the Kabbalah, I mean, all of it, I did loads of different things.
All means.
They were all means, indeed they were, except for sitting quietly and shutting up. The idea of doing it's a meme, but when you sit there and let go of the memes, they go away. And I think after all of those memes I chased after, I settled down to that practice because it really does help to be able to drop it all. When you sit down, like I do every morning before I start the day, sit down, drop everything. That's quite useful. But that's all it was. That was all part of my massive exploration in my youth of trying to find something that would help me understand who am I, why am I here, what's the point of it, or what is this anyway?
Why, for example, would alien abductions have become so popular? I mean, as a meme, which I presume that is the belief in an alien abduction.
Yes.
Why would you? Why would so many people? And a lot of people do, yeah.
It's a very interesting question, and I think I stumbled across the answer to that accidentally. I was doing some work on borderline experiences, things like out-of-body and near-death experiences, but other kinds of things where imagination and reality become confused. You can imagine why I was interested in that. And I put out lots of questionnaires and got lots and lots of responses. And an awful lot of the people, it was quite clear, had what's called sleep paralysis. Now, when you are in dreaming sleep, your whole body is paralyzed. It has to be, otherwise you would act out your dreams. And it's a safety mechanism, if you like. And normally you don't know anything about it. But what can happen is that either you're so tired that you go into dreaming sleep very quickly, which happens to night shift workers and nurses and things, or you wake up in some odd way such that the paralysis is still there while you're half awake.
Is this a lucid dream?
No, that's something completely different.
Right.
No, so in sleep paralysis, you're still paralyzed, but you're partly aware of what's going on around you. Now, what happens in that state can be absolutely terrifying if you don't know what it is, because you feel as if you can't breathe. So, because your breathing is still on automatic, and if you try to breathe, you can't control it. So it feels as though there's something squashing on your chest. You're still sexually aroused, because in dream sleep, you're always sexually aroused. So you've still got sexual arousal.
Are you really?
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Yes, 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 yes. I'll wake you up one night in the middle of the night, we'll see.
Just let me know when you're coming.
No, that would spoil it. So you've got that. You've got this, as in out-of-the-body experience, this kind of floaty, drifty kind of feeling that you could be lifting out of the bed. All of these things happen physiologically in sleep paralysis, and nearly every culture has some kind of myth to account for it. So there's the old hag. We used to have hagging in England. It's only now remaining in Newfoundland, where people actually talk about the old hag who comes in the night. But there are traditions in Africa, in Thailand as the grey ghost. There's all over the place these different traditions. Now, it looks like alien abductions are our modern sleep paralysis myth. So there you are. Imagine that you woke up one morning and you didn't know about sleep paralysis. And you find yourself lying in bed. You feel as if there's some creature there. You have this awful sense of presence that's produced in the temporal lobe as well. You're absolutely sure somebody's there, but you can't see them. There's a humming and buzzing noise. You feel creepy feelings on your skin. You feel sexual arousal, and the creepy feelings, you feel like somebody might be, interfering with you sexually. I mean, what are you going to think? If you've watched that television program about the aliens who come and take the eggs, and for breeding experiments and coming, and blah, of course you're going to think you've been abducted. And then if you go and go and get hypnotized and they suggest the ideas even more, well, it'll become a complete abduction story. So I think that those memes are there because we need something to explain this perfectly natural experience of sleep paralysis, and some meme or other will pop in and do the job.
You sound very reductionist.
Yeah.
Is that what you would... I mean, how far are you from Francis Crick, who said we are just a collection of neurons?
In some ways, very far, and others not. I think reductionism is an essential tool in science. It is so powerful and wonderful, but you can go too far with it. You have to have the sort of reductionism that says, here's a complicated phenomenon. I want to understand what lies underneath it. What simpler processes give rise to this complex thing? Out of what simple things does this complexity emerge, for example? Good reductionists will be able to look at reducing things while not spoiling the thing you're looking for. The bad reductionist is where you kind of get rid of the thing you're trying to find in the first place, and then I think it is wrong to be too reductionist.
So when you're doing your Zen meditation and you're losing the means, what's left when they've gone?
Ah, that's such a difficult question. This is a very, very common question, people asking this, I mean, amongst Buddhist-type people I know and philosophers and so on. A lot of people say, well, there can't be anything left. Dan Dennett, for example, who says that we are just consciousness is just a collection of memes, must therefore say when all the memes are gone, there's nothing left. Mm-hmm. I would say from personal experience, when all the memes are gone, of course there's something left. There's, I can't actually say what it is. It's this. I can't convey it, because if I did, that would be memes. And, you know, but nevertheless, there is something, but I can't justify that very, very well. So, but that's what I would say.
Scientific fashion.
But going back to Francis Crick, when Francis says, you're nothing but a pack of neurons, it's not the reductionism I object to. I think it's the wrong reduction. I would say, because I've already said why I think that the self is an illusion created by memes, you are nothing but neurons and a body and a brain and memes. Nothing but in the sense, I don't believe there's a soul or a spirit or something like that, but it's not enough just to say the neurons. That does not explain what it is to be a human. We need memes as well.
I think Roger Penrose suggested that there were links with quantum mechanics. Consciousness is physical, as far as I can understand what he's saying, but not as we know it yet, and it might not even be the quantum mechanics that we know. Do you think that's a possibility, that the thing that you can't say about what's left after all the memes have gone will sooner or later be able to be defined in terms that we don't yet know about?
Yes, if I take the very general part of your question, yes, I think that's possible. I think we don't really know where to look, and it could be that. I also think there's an interesting comparison with quantum theory, something like this. You know, one of the effects in quantum theory is that you can't measure something without changing it. And that's true of consciousness as well. And there's this very odd fact. I mean, if I say to you, are you conscious now? You're always going to say yes. And if you say it to yourself, am I conscious now? You're always going to say yes. But what about a moment ago? Hang on a minute, was I? Because I think what happens, it's something like mindfulness in Buddhist practice, but something like when you ask that question, something strange happens. When you ask, am I conscious now? Ah, okay. But somehow you make a self, you make a world, you make it, and then you get yourself into this illusion that I'm in here and the world's out there. But perhaps a moment ago, the brain was just getting on with its stuff and it wasn't. So that is a kind of similarity which I'm interested in exploring. But if your question is, are Hameroff and Penrose right about that we can explain consciousness in terms of quantum coherence in the microtubules? No, I absolutely don't think so. I think they're just mystery mongering. They're just taking one mystery, quantum mechanics, and another mystery, consciousness, and saying, hey, we can explain one in terms of the other. And I really don't think that works. And I don't think most scientists or philosophers do, who've looked into it. It just, in the end, doesn't help us.